Up next from the O'Reilly Media 2005 Open Source Convention, an interview with Jonathan Schwartz from IT Conversations. Hello, this is Doug Kay, the executive producer of IT Conversations, and today I'm excited to bring you another session from the 7th Annual O'Reilly Open Source Convention held in Portland, Oregon, August 1st through 5th, 2005. IT Conversations is underwritten by listener donations. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. And now, here's our presentation from the O'Reilly Open Source Convention.
So I would like to bring up our last guest for the morning keynotes. He's a very interesting, very controversial figure, has not yet been fired for being a blogger, although several times I guess it must have come close. I'd like to welcome one of the most prolific commenters on open source and one of the most the man who heads some of the projects that have been bitterly fought over and fought for in the open source community. So I'd like to please welcome Jonathan Schwartz. So this is your first time at OSCON, so I've got a list of tricky questions for you. But I think it's always polite to start with a nice, soft question. So I'd like to find out about Andy Bechtolsheim.
Right.
Sorry.
You should probably talk to Andy about Andy.
You sure about that?
Well, I'm not sure I can give you any personal insights.
I'm not looking for a psychoanalysis.
He's very tall.
There we go. Well, that was the easy question over and done with. So, open source Java. Open source Java.
Right.
Now, the feeling from Sun for a long time was that you didn't want open source Java. Java didn't need to be open sourced. There was no need for it, and the community didn't want it. And now there is an Apache project to implement an open source Java stack. So I'd like to know what the reaction is.
So I think in general, I'm thrilled to see open source implementations of all technology in the world. We will continue to drive and be at the forefront of making open source safe for enterprises, as well as continue to drive the evolution of technologies as diverse as Apache and OpenOffice and Firefox and Mozilla. I mean, we're contributors, obviously, to all of that. So I think the concerns we have around whether Java should ship under a license deemed open by OSI is separate and apart from, is the code to Java available? Because obviously the code to Java is available. Just go take a peek at it. We have concerns, obviously, on the desktop of forking. Why? Just look back a few years and see what one of the biggest threats to the viability of Java was. It was Microsoft forking it. And I think just as we've seen most open source projects tip toward a dominant provider, because I think we have seen that. It's not something we talk about here, but there's a reason why when you go into the enterprise, and frankly when you go into Yahoo, you see a lot of Red Hat and not a lot of anything else. It's because the world can't afford lots and lots and lots of different things to go do the same task. So in general, I'm thrilled to see more open source innovation. I'm thrilled to see open source implementations of Java. I think the jury's, you know, not back on how we will continue the future evolution of Java. I think we're obviously paying attention, we're aware of the issues, and we also think that maybe there's a new world emerging and maybe there's opportunity for change.
Will Sun be participating in the project? I believe IBM announced support in one shape or form, whether it be moral or bodies on the ground.
So there's over 900 contributing members to the Java community process. So to ask whether we're contributing to the evolution of Java, you know, yeah, I think we're going to be pretty vested in the ongoing evolution of Java.
I was thinking of the Apache open source Java project.
I'm sure folks at Sun will be contributing to Apache as they do today and to other projects at Apache. So whether it's Derby or, you know, the open source or Harmony or, you know, any of the variants and offshoots, I'm sure you'll see Sun employees involved. I mean, we don't spend a lot of our time trying to figure out what to stop Sun employees from getting involved in. Just look at our blog infrastructure.
So I'll leave open source Java. The other big project I've seen come out of Sun lately is Open Solaris. How has that been received?
I think it's been received fabulously. I mean, we've had 2 million license downloads in the past 6 months or so, and a huge community of folks, you know, building around it. So I think Andrew was maybe a little bit nervous because I'm about to meet with his boss about starting a Solaris tree. And I can certainly understand that there's a concern there, but you know, we see the more participants and the more innovation happening is a good thing. Competition's a good thing. So I think when you look at where we see the future of Solaris, and frankly where we see the future of Linux, neither are going away anytime soon. Both are wonderful and safe. Anyone who tells you open source isn't safe is just flat out lying to you. Just go ask General Motors that signed a, you know, worldwide site license for an open source operating system, happens to be called Solaris 10. And I think there's just more to come. There's more innovation and opportunity everywhere.
So one of the big sources of conflict around Open Solaris, or at least sources of comment around Open Solaris, was the licensing terms, which essentially prevented commingling of Linux code and
No, that was
Solaris.
The GPL that prevented commingling. The CDDL is a license that allows anyone to intermingle.
The CDDL was a license that you chose, however. So in some sense, then, Sun chose not to permit commingling.
So let me give you a couple customer stories. You know, I've been with several of our OEMs, so original equipment manufacturers who embed Solaris into their products and then ship them. And they made statements to us like, if you use the GPL, we can't use Solaris. And so that was one set of choices we had to go grapple with. Secondly, we didn't own all of the technology within Solaris to be able to dictate to anyone else who mingled with Solaris that they change their license terms. So I think the reality is, you know, I think unlike Eric Raymond, who believes the GPL should go away, I'm a big fan of the GPL. OpenOffice obviously ships under it. And a, you know, a huge spectrum of work we do at Sun obviously ships under it, whether it's GNOME or, you know, any of the extensions onto it. But I don't think there's one license or one hammer for all nails in the world. Choice is a good thing. And just like if you turned on the TV set and there was only one channel, that's not a world that I would be interested in living in. I think there's going to be diversity, and competition's a good thing. We should allow, you know, 1,000 flowers to bloom and not just say that's the flower that we have chosen from on high. That's the one that's going to bloom, because the odds are it's going to be a kind of ugly flower.
It was actually Chairman Mao who said let 1,000 flowers bloom.
Which is curious, isn't it?
Yes. One of the more misquoted pieces of his work.
Well, so, you know, I think the selection of the CDDL and the selection of a license that gave developers choice is something that's obviously pretty important to us. We want people to have choice. And for those that aren't familiar with the CDDL license, it's a files-based license. It's a derivative of the Mozilla license. The Mozilla license, last I checked, was the most popular open source license in the marketplace, just given the volume of software that's been delivered out from under it. I think that's different than in the open source operating system world. But nonetheless, that freedom that conveys to a developer, that BSD-like freedom that says, hey, it's your business, you figure out how you want to run it. If you would like to contribute back to the community, we'd like to invite you to do so. But there's an element of self-confidence that we had in using the CDDL, which said, we believe there's going to be a lot of contributions from folks who want to make contributions back, as opposed to telling them you must and dictating the terms under which they could do so.
Have there been a lot of contributions coming back?
Absolutely, and there's a huge community. You know, I think there's probably 7,000-8,000 folks now registered worldwide, user groups popping up all over the world. And again, 2 million licenses had to go to someone. And there's a, you know, curious thing about those licenses being downloaded. There's a 100% attach rate to a developer and a computer. And last I checked, that was in a, you know, an important demographic for us.
So I guess the important figure then will be the ongoing use of the software that they've downloaded. Is there any way to measure that?
To me, I think the important thing is that we have more innovation in the marketplace, more awareness that open source is safe, can be used to go run businesses as diverse as General Motors or Yahoo. I would be thrilled to see, you know, 1,000 distros of Open Solaris propagating in the world. I'd be thrilled to see, you know, cooperation and collaboration on upstack components that don't necessarily have to get into a debate over license religion. And I think we're going to continue to see a growing number of registrants and participants. In the end of the day, the most important thing for any open source project isn't, though, the number of community contributors. It's the number of users. And I think the number of users that will be served by Solaris is obviously how many users will there be of GM? Well, it's not just going to be about folks in their IT shop. It's going to be about those of you that drive GM cars, being able to ping back through OnStar, you're hitting Solaris. Or those of you that are in the Apache community and you're actually, you know, hitting the Apache servers, which are also running, you know, Open Solaris.
That's interesting. I'd heard that, so Sun, in the early days of the internet, gave away a lot of hardware to try and seed the spread of the internet. And I hear that's starting to happen again with the open source communities. Can you tell us something about that?
We will continue not to simply be a user of open source technology and put up a poster showing you all the products that we're, you know, harvesting from the marketplace to use. We're going to continue to make contributions back to that. Every project we have at Sun, and it may not be there now, but every product at Sun will at some point be both free and open source. Everyone. Which means we will be taking the 7,000-8,000 software developers at Sun, and they will be working on open source and free products.
So that's including Java?
In one form or another, yes. Well, look, as you well know, Java's already free, which is why we're downloading about 20 million runtimes a month. And for those of you that missed that, 20 million downloads a month.
And Firefox just broke the 70 million mark. So
yeah, in
comparison.
Cumulative.
Yes.
So, and we're on a race, and you know, Mitchell and I were conspiring how we can escalate one another's numbers. So I think all of that's goodness. That's just creating more freedom and more opportunity. And at the end of the day, we're obviously as focused on getting users to adopt as we are about, you know, bragging about it on a slide.
So glad I don't have your network bills. 70,
yeah, that's
20 million
a month. Big bill, trust me.
So one of the things that Sun was recently involved in was the European patent fight.
Yeah.
What is your take on software patents?
It's a complex question. And I think I would...
Can you give us a simple answer?
I think software patents are largely inapplicable. I think patents have been misused to stifle innovation rather than promote and protect it. But I think the reality is they can serve both roles. Look, we've been a victim of patent litigation. You know, just go back and look at our filings. We paid the Kodak Corporation... when you go buy a camera, just remember that Kodak sued us for intellectual property over a single patent, which they acquired for the purpose of litigating. I don't think that's consistent with the objectives of the original, you know, patent, you know, philosophy. So we are not a troll. We're not out there finding people to sue. We're out there trying to protect the community. And what we've done with the CDDL is said, if you pick up Open Solaris, and by the way, going forward with all products at Sun, to the extent that you're a licensee of any of those products, you now have inherited the protection of the 5,000 plus patents we have, you know, related to that technology, which again just continues to drive the umbrella forward. So just as Red Hat is picking up patents, just as SpikeSource is picking up patents, just as lots of open source community companies are picking up patents, we've got a huge war chest. Our intent with that war chest is to use it to protect the innovation which ultimately creates market opportunity for Sun, not to go through it and try to figure out, okay, we got a patent here, who do we nail with it? Not going to be the most productive way of driving innovation.
So if the Linux kernel were to implement dtrace, Sun wouldn't employ the patents against
that? Knock yourself out.
Knock yourself out. Wonderful to hear. Thank you. Why, that's so much for that curveball.
And if you haven't seen dtrace, by the way, by all means, please go download Solaris 10 and take a look at dtrace.
Yeah, so what are the reasons that then people should use Open Solaris over Linux, given that... Linux has enormous mindshare and has been the open source poster child for many years.
So a couple things. One, there's no such thing as Java in the sense that you have to look at a product. I mean, there's an ideal called Java. And there's no such thing called Linux. Linux is an ideal. It's a wonderful ideal. But then there are products. And so if you compare Solaris to a product, let's engage in the discussion about the diversity of the way we approach a problem, that, you know, how do we deal with dtrace and diagnosing production systems? I mean, those are the things that we're focused on. But I think in respect to how do we compete, you know, Open Solaris versus Linux, there's multiple products, just like there's multiple distros out there. And individuals are going to make the choices about the licenses they want to use, about the conventions, the communities they want to be a part of, and they're all going to make individual choices. The good news is now, unlike a few years back, and I think we need to update Andrew on what's happened with Solaris, given that it's now available on every x86 and x64 computer made in the marketplace, given that the code is completely available, now we're not engaging in a religious or philosophical discussion about Solaris versus Linux. Now we're saying, look, here's a product, here's your product, let's go compare them. Let's go run performance benchmarks and talk about functionality and diversity. That's what we can have the discussion on. So it's no longer about competing against a social movement as the big evil company that has proprietary products that they're trying to withhold from you. Now it's about, look, let's get the politics out of the way. Let's talk about innovation. And where should Red Hat run well? And where should Solaris run well? And how do we, you know, maybe collaborate and cooperate in ways that we haven't historically to go put pressure on the real company who has a problem open sourcing their code? And it's not just Yahoo with Messenger and Flickr, which aren't open source. It's also a few other companies that build operating systems that have yet to make their code available.
I'd like to know which one you're thinking of.
I really believe that Hewlett-Packard should open source HPUX. You know, and especially on Itanium, because that it's important for my home server that I get that, you know.
I'm not sure they're prepared for the 20 downloads a month they would get.
That's right. They'd have a hard time keeping the Itanium infrastructure up.
So what do you think is coming next for open source? You're a big thinker in the area. You blog regularly about what catches your mind. And what do you see coming?
So the first thing I see happening, and I think Andrew and I and Jeremy would all agree with this, there is just a tidal wave washing over the marketplace that suggests if you're really committed to interoperability and choice for your consumers, you must deliver your code into the marketplace. That customers are demanding that. That's number one. Number two, the price of delivering software is going to zero. Because remember back 10 years ago, if you wanted a product, you had to go to a retailer, spend some money, they'd give you a box wrapped in plastic, which you take home and throw away, and you take the CD, and then you throw that away. And that was, you know, paying for access to products. That's obviously going away. Now everything will be freely available and distributed over the web. Innovation is increasing. Just look at Firefox compared to IE. Which would you pick? I know which I pick. It's Firefox, by the way. And
IE for Solaris is still lagging? Is that the story?
It is. You know, we've been working with Microsoft. It's driving innovation. Because now you're not going to compete on the basis of, you know, how much do you cost? It's both going to be free, both going to be available, both going to be open source. Guess what? You know, you're going to have to start innovating or you're just going to get plowed under. You know, comments I've made recently, why did NetBeans get so good? One word, Eclipse, period. So, you know, having competition is a good thing. You know, our showing up in the marketplace to go compete against some of the OSs that were historically the only ones that were available in open source is probably going to put a little pressure on those other operating systems to get, you know, a little more innovative. Certainly we've seen the pressure, we've felt it. And I think, you know, the combination of those three things, more free products being available in the marketplace, the price of accessing those products going to zero, and frankly the services, you know, and again, my favorite examples are Yahoo and Google, and in fact I'll give you my favorite story about open source. I was on a panel with Dan Rosenzweig, who's the president of Yahoo, and a really good guy, by the way. And John Markoff was doing the interviewing, and he said, and he just totally threw me a softball, he said, I was just up with Bill Gates, and Bill Gates says that open source and free software are communism. How do you feel about that? And I said, interesting, Yahoo's a free search service. Dan, has anyone ever called you a communist? And he said, no. And they just announced $1 billion in earnings. So I think we're moving away from simply free software to free services. And if you look at the adoption around the world of the number of people coming online, why is it accelerating? Because it's getting so cheap. And that's a wonderful thing. That creates more opportunity and more marketplace, by the way, for all of us in the room.
So if there's free software and there's free services, where is the money to be made then?
You need only look at Yahoo. Look at Google. Is anybody wondering?
Advertising?
Well, I think it depends on what you're going to do. I think Kim with SpikeSource has probably found an alternative mechanism, which, I mean, free software, all it really talks about is the price of accessing the software has gone to zero. It doesn't mean there's no longer any value to it, because the value may be in service and support. The value may be in an update network, as is the case with Red Hat. The value may be in ads, in the case of, you know, Yahoo. It may be in, you know, location services if you're Google or Vodafone. I think there's more and more opportunity. The perfect analogy, and I know it ruffles some feathers to say it, but in the mobile handset marketplace, I mean, how many of you have mobile phones? You know, the most popular handsets in the world are free. Why? Because they're free. And it's not because the code is available to them or you can disassemble the phone and reassemble it on your own. It's because they're free. And that's a good thing. Now, does anyone wonder how the carriers are going to make money off a free handset? No. I mean, the ones that have to wonder about it, they're going to go out of business pretty quickly. And the ones that are monetizing it, there's a huge amount of money for them to go make. So I think it forces us to have a different conversation. It's not about how much do you pay when you go to Egghead to buy a product. Now it's, what's the value that this provider will offer to me that's above and beyond what the rest of the marketplace offers?
But I think there's an important distinction between open source software and cell phones, and that cell phones are fundamentally opposed to being open source. The mobile networks are fundamentally opposed to being open source.
How many of you believe that is a sustainable strategy? don't see a lot of hands.
So you were saying, Dan, that the cell phone is a model for the new economy, and yet you're also saying that it's unsustainable?
No, I'm saying that the economic model of the cell phone community, and look, the economic model of office productivity, why on earth would you buy Microsoft Office if you can get Open Office for free and it's actually more innovative?
Can I say, in my experience, Open Office has been slow and buggy, and so that... They would pay for something that is slow and buggy in different ways.
And have you used OpenOffice 8?
No, I haven't used OpenOffice 8.
I would invite you to return to using OpenOffice 8, as obviously we're working on the slow and buggy part along with the community. It's good news. There's competition there. And so I think the economic models are distinct from the network models and the openness. Look, Yahoo's not open source. It's not. I mean, if you want to get access to source code at Yahoo, there's some that they'll provide. They're not going to give you it all. But Yahoo's free as a service, and they found other ways to go build value around it. So I think the economic models of free products are certainly changing because the network is so simple now to connect with a consumer opportunity. But I think the technical models, the intellectual property models, there's going to be a lot of change there. And everything from patents to closed networks to, you know, strong authentication.
So for you, the free and free software is all free as in beer?
No. I think it's a seesaw, and seesaws don't work unless you have somebody on both ends of it. Part of it is free, as in the economic definition of free, and part of it is freedom, which is the freedom to make choices. And absolutely, I believe in both.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jonathan.
Likewise. It's been a pleasure.
Much appreciated. Don't forget your cell phone.
You've been listening to a presentation delivered at the O'Reilly Open Source Convention held in Portland, Oregon, August 1st through 5th, 2005. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. IT Conversations is listener-supported, so please contribute to our tip jar. 100% of your donation will go to our team of volunteers who produce these programs for you in their spare time. The series producer for IT Conversations coverage of OSCON is Darusha Wame. The website producer for this program was Mark Kelso. Post-production audio by Stuart Hunter. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me for more coverage of OSCON here on IT Conversations.